issues.
Hi, I'm Greg Salmieri for the Objectivism Program at the Salem Center here at the University of Texas, Austin. This is another episode of Choose Your Issues, our podcast. Joining me is Ben Bayer of the Ayn Rand Institute. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Greg.
So what's on our docket for today?
Well, maybe we should mention that we've got a new camera set up.
Oh, yeah, we're experimenting with the cameras a little bit differently.
Occasionally we will be split screen. Occasionally we'll have a camera focused directly on us. I'm not sure which one Michael has on us right now because there's a delay on the YouTube thing that I'm watching.
We're here in the GSB building of McCombs School of Business here on the 40 acres and experimenting with coming live to you guys again. So we were going to be here last week with Ankar Gatte talking about level playing fields and, in effect, egalitarianism. We have a little bit of a different take on it this week. We were, of course, precluded from doing it last week because the campus was closed.
Well, the city was practically closed because various power outages. Hopefully the power will be with us. There's still people in town without it. As tech issues go, though, something else new is this very strange promo image that you selected for this week's topic. Maybe you should say something about that to orient.
We were having some workshops the last couple of weeks, and I was spending a lot of time with a friend, Ibis of Aperia, as he's sometimes called, who was visiting and giving us some thoughts on how to do things for YouTube. And he suggested better hooks for the titles. We'll talk about the title of this one and thumbnail images. So when we were talking about level playing fields, I had kind of come to that topic through thinking of it as a topic to do soon because of a Washington Post article on Nepo babies, as they called them, a term that I hadn't encountered before. And when I asked Ibis, well, like, what would be a good hook or a good, internet trendy thing to connect to the topic of level playing fields, he searched around in some of his places and came up with the same hook that I had originally interested me in it, which is this idea of Nepo babies, which are all the rage now. So that's how we
what
got that.
What is a Nepo baby?
A Nepo baby is a baby of nepotism, somebody who was born to parents in a field and therefore is advanced well into the field. We'll talk more about them in a moment. And then there was the other bit of advice I got, which is you want thumbnails for each of your videos. So interesting thumbnails. So I got Dolly, the AI image generator, to draw a baby with a silver spoon in his mouth on an unlevel playing field, and this is what we came up with.
This is certainly not kind of clip art you would normally be able to find on Shutterstock or something like that. So
yeah, I've been kind of experimenting with the AI, both the ChatGPT-3 and the Dolly, the image generator, for a while, and I haven't found too many actual uses for it. But it's very interesting to explore the technology, and maybe kind of surrealist thumbnails is a good...
It's good for illustrating highly obscure themes and connections.
Maybe. We'll see.
So what was it about the topic of the article on the subject of Nepo babies that drew your attention?
Well, just the idea of going from complaints about Nepo babies, which apparently had been trending in some quarters of the internet, and the complaint was that this celebrity is that other celebrity's kid, and did you know that this person got their start in the industry and through that way, mostly the film industry, I think, but different industries like that, to, well, aren't we all really Nepo babies in some sense? Didn't we all have advantages, or most of us, or those of us complaining about it? The author of the Post article, after all, went to the same prestigious university that my father did, and so on and so forth. And is there really a level playing field? Wouldn't it all be very different, and we'd all be from in different places in life? And I'm really opposed to the idea of level playing fields. I mean, they're great in sports, but the idea of yearning for one in life, of thinking that there could or should be one in life, I think is really based on a kind of pernicious confusion. And so that's what I wanted to talk about, and we'll come to that in time. But I don't know. You've been looking into all the discussions of the Nepo baby, so you probably know more about it than I do.
I read a few articles, including the one that you mentioned, the one that seemed to touch off the discussion, at least most recently, was this one in the Washington Post.
Yeah, that's the one I read. Apparently, that was picking up on things going on in the trendier corners of the internet that the likes of us, don't know, only the youth does. And from there, the Washington Post brought it into the consciousness of the, elder.
Yeah, I think it started before that with a piece in Vulture magazine, which is sort of a Hollywood culture watching place for think pieces. And that piece was called How a Nepo Baby is Born. And it was really just a survey of lots of different famous celebrities who derive from their celebrity parents in one way or another. They also put together this vast taxonomy of different types of Nepo babies, because some of them are themselves A-list celebrities and some of them are people you've never heard of, which I think is interesting because, celebrity parents, musicians, actors, actresses get their kids jobs in their business. And it's interesting that you haven't heard of all of them. So it is the case that they can give them a leg up, but that doesn't necessarily make them famous. There's certainly some famous ones you've heard of, many that you haven't. And so that right there raises a question of how significant is this of a phenomena that's worth conceptualizing with a funny name. There was a great line,
an insulting name.
Yeah, there was a great line in a I can't remember if it was in that piece or in this one I read in Discourse. For every Anderson Cooper who made a name for himself, he's the son of Gloria Vanderbilt. There's 100 Hunter Bidens. Many of them don't survive to tell their tale, which I think is quite true. But the other thing that struck me was, so there's someone shocked and surprised that there's nepotism in Hollywood. I thought this has been known for ages and ages since the inception of Hollywood itself.
It didn't come as a surprise to me.
But even next thing they're going to say is that college professors' kids get into better colleges.
Well, that can't be true. But even whether it's nepotism and what nepotism means, I think is worth thinking about. Because I don't think it's largely or primarily due to nepotism that the children of the people in the entertainment industry are often in the entertainment industry.
Well, so first, we should get clear on what nepotism actually is, if it's anything. How would you define it?
Well, what does the internet say it is? I mean, what's the dictionary definition?
Let's see
what Google.
I think it derives from giving favors to your nephews, right? The first Google definition is the practice among those with power or influence of favoring relatives, friends, or associates, especially by giving them jobs. So it's gone a little bit past nephews. I don't know why nephews ever got singled out in the first place.
But it's the favoring with jobs, right? So in other words, you have a job you're hiring, and you hire a relative, a younger relative. And I think but I don't like the earlier part of that definition, the practice of people with power of what?
Power or influence of favoring relatives.
Of favoring them. But like favoring them in what way? I think the specific thing is you give someone a job, or maybe you pull some strings for them or you do something. But for example, you teach a relative your skill rather than teaching it to a complete stranger. You, give a relative information. And part of having relatives, certainly having children, is that you're partial to them and you pass on knowledge, abilities, training, etc., to them. That's part of why people want to have kids. And I don't think you need a concept for in effect, bringing up or educating your kids. And it's, no surprise that they should be better educated in, have more knowledge about, have more kind of connections to, the fields their parents are in. But there's a different thing than that when you give someone a job, give someone a break because they're, a relative. And I think that's what nepotism means, as I understand the term. Even there, I'm not sure it's always bad, but.
So there was, I think in the original, in the Washington Post article, yeah, there was an interesting, point that they quoted Tom Hanks on. His explanation for why his son Truman is appearing in his new movie, Tom Hanks told Reuters, "We have four kids. They are all very creative. They are all involved in some brand of storytelling. And if we were a plumbing supply business or if we ran the florist shop down the street, the whole family would be putting in time at some point, even if it was just inventory at the end of the year." And the author of this piece says, "Yeah, but plumbing supply business isn't famously sought after career path that grants continuous employment to only a lucky few. Is that true? You never hear about people waiting tables or slinging espressos until they get their big plumbing supply break." But then this I thought was noteworthy. "Entertainment careers, on the other hand, at least the most visible ones, have to be broken into because most of us are locked out. Or if it's not locked, then the door to Hollywood success is at least firmly closed." Well, I'm glad the author thought to catch himself on the question of whether it's locked. Because, I mean, isn't all that's true here that the Hollywood industry, like every other industry, has some standards, fair or unfair, just like any other industry does, and you have to have some kind of pedigree to qualify in their eyes as meeting those standards, whether you're going to get hired or not. So
pedigree, I mean, means who you're born to and where you come from. So that,
well,
it's
used in a broader way than that, because I'm thinking, like, people talk about academic pedigree. Where did you go to school?
Where did you learn?
Yeah,
but I mean, like, is it the case that most people in motion picture, most people in starring roles in motion pictures had parents who were actors?
I have no way of quantifying that. I doubt it.
So I doubt it's, you know, even the top 50 or 25%. So to say most of us are locked out, it's really hard to get into, but it's, unless it's the case that this is the predominant way into a field, that's a kind of bizarre way to put it. Some people have a leg up or have help or have some advantage that you might think is unfair, but that's not getting into something that most of us are locked out to. There's no lock. There's a difficult hurdle to hurdle, and some people get a leg up hurdling it. We can talk about, you know, whether that's right or fair, but
I mean, I was actually able to come up with, to give this, here's the best case I can give. Tell me what you think. For why actually getting, why, say, actors getting their kids jobs as actors, mm-hmm, could actually have some value to the companies that are hiring these kids. So audiences are interested in famous people. They certainly watch the movies that the initially famous people are in because they like this actress or actor and they want to see the next show because they're in them. Mm-hmm. That includes being interested in their spawn. If you're a fan of Goldie Hawn, and you find out that what's her name,
the girl from Almost Famous, Kate Hudson.
Kate Hudson is her daughter. You might be like, I'm a Goldie Hawn fan. I wonder what her daughter looks like and if she has any kind of talent like her mother does. And you watch the movie for that reason. And if you're a fan, that might actually be something you're interested in. And that makes people watch the movie. That brings in money. It's good for ROI. Now, I don't know if a policy of that practiced with every role in Hollywood would be very wise, but it's not, in fact, the policy that they use.
And there are lots of other reasons. So actors typically look good.
And they look like they're famous.
Way that audiences like, in any case. And kids often look like their parents.
Yeah.
So if you have a particularly beautiful actress married to a particularly beautiful actor, or whether or not they're particularly beautiful, such that people like the way they look, it's a decent chance their kid will look more or less like them.
Apparently Cindy Crawford's daughter is raking it in right now because she looks just like her mom did when she, like 30, 40 years ago.
And similarly, there's a lot to know about what it's like to be on a movie set and how it is to work in the industry and so forth. And presumably people who know more of that are, you know, more valuable to a company. So there's lots of reasons why. But the whole concept, it's a similar thing to what I think about college admissions or lots of other topics we've talked about here. There's this public utility mindset, this idea that the motion pictures are here to give out jobs fairly or equitably to us. everyone's owed an equal shot at a job in the motion pictures. Somehow Hollywood was provided by God as the means of distributing breaks to people. But that's not true. There's no such thing as Hollywood that's distributing breaks or jobs. There are different movie studios with different directors and different producers and different people hiring people for different purposes in pursuit of their ends to make movies, trading with the people who want to view them. And there's no kind of system here to talk about. And what you can talk about is the individual decisions that people are making or kind of policies by which people are making decisions and whether they're good or bad, whether they're just or not. But to think about whether they're just, you can't think about some cosmic standard of distribution by which breaks are given out to everybody, or whether there's a level playing field in life as though there could be such a thing, or as though the concept of it makes any sense, as though life is a game and a competition, neither of which it is. Rather, you have to think about the particular decisions that are being made and the principles on which they're being made and what principles they ought to be being made on. And there are lots of cases, I'm sure, where people hire less qualified people over more qualified people because there's a family connection. And in some cases, you can think of plausible reasons for that. Maybe they know them better, they can trust them more or something like that. But in a lot of cases, I think it's just a kind of prejudice. I think it's unjust, and I think it's bad for the person's business. And if you're a manager in a company who's hiring people that way and passing over more qualified applicants who would do the job better, you're doing a bad job as a manager, and your boss should, you know, whoever's the higher manager of you should look into it and notice if you're doing things like that and fire you for it or make you not do it. And
but likewise, that's not what most CEO of this is right? Of
a company and you're doing it badly, you know, you're making your company worse and you're going to suffer for that. But I don't think most of the things that are being called Nepo babies is anything like that. What I think a lot of these situations are, and you can see it in the author of the piece in the Post worrying about maybe we're all Nepo babies, is that people have advantages in life because of who they were born to, how they were brought up. We're not all starting in the same place. Life isn't a level playing field. And I think that this whole idea that life could or should be a level playing field, the question of whether it is a level playing field, or the questions of whether large fields in life, like the motion picture industry or higher education or anything else, is a level playing field, is a morally noxious question. It is something that comes from and contributes to moral failing. It makes you a worse person to think this way. Life is not a game. Life is serious. It's real. It's not something that's constructed for some artificial purpose. It's living. It's what we're doing on the earth. And you have to take very great care when you analogize it to a game. It's not. You can make the analogy for particular purposes where it has a point, and we can think about what those are. But life's not a game. There's no such thing as winning or losing life. There's having a good or a bad life or a better or worse life or being a loser in that sense or a winner. But you don't win life by besting other people in life or lose life by being bested by them. And moreover, there are no rankings in life. You don't come in first or second or third in life like you can in a race. And we could wonder if the race was fair and the track was even or so forth, or whether your track was bumpier than mine if I came in three places ahead of you. You see, there's a lot in discussions of privilege and so forth, so-called privilege. The whole set of metaphors is misleading, mistaken, toxic, and I think really vicious. Life is not a competition.
Well, let me play devil's advocate on this a bit and come up with the best case I can think of for why even just the game analogy or metaphor is appropriate. So, okay, there aren't winners and losers in life. There isn't first, second, third place. But there is the need to evaluate performance, which is what a game does. If it's a sport, especially, you're deciding who's the fastest runner, who's the toughest boxer, et cetera. Employers need to assess performance in order to do things like hire, or universities need to assess performance in order to admit students. And so if you want to see kind of control for the relevant variables, like who's actually the best actor, then wouldn't you want to have it be, I don't know, a double blind kind of experiment where you don't know who their parent is. You just want to put them in a room, have an audition and test how good they are at acting. And if somebody's if somebody's in effect putting their fingers on the scales by pulling strings, weird mixed metaphor, you know, to get somebody an audition they otherwise wouldn't have gotten, or to get them a part without an audition. Isn't that a bit like what's happening in a game where the rules are unfairly disadvantaging one player or another?
So often what's needed for a certain job, generally what's needed for a certain job to do it well is a whole range of things. And it's hard to kind of isolate them and tell what they are and tell which ones matter more than one another and so forth, which is why hiring is hard. And anyone who's done it finds it hard. But often you can identify certain things that are particularly important to how someone's going to do at a job, to what you need in the job, a particular skill. And you can design tests, competitions, games, etc., to try to control for the level of ability at that skill, for how skilled are they at that thing. And if you're right that what's needed for the position is someone who's, say, really, really good at math, and you're right that this test or game identifies the people who are best at math, then it can be a really wise hiring choice to use that game or skill or test or whatever to find the people to hire. And in many contexts, that's going to be good. And so you give the example of auditions, for example. And a lot of classical orchestras at a certain time instituted this policy of having members audition for the orchestra behind a screen so that the people judging them could only hear how they were playing, and they couldn't tell other things about them. And as a result, orchestras became much more gender integrated. It turned out that people who didn't know that they were they just thought men sounded better playing cello or whatever when they could see that they were men. And when they couldn't see, it turned out they liked a lot more women cellists than before. And if what you're trying to do with an orchestra is just get the people who are capable of playing the best and who sound the best, and that's what you want with an orchestra, which seems to me to be a very laudable goal if you're creating an orchestra, then having a screen like that will help you do that. And it's a great audition technique. It's not necessarily, though, the only goal you might have in forming an orchestra. You might want an orchestra that looks a certain way, for example, because it has to be cast in a certain movie. Or you might want an orchestra that people in the audience will be able to relate to. So you want people who look more like them for kids if you're going and touring around and you want every kid to think, maybe I could be in this orchestra. People now are talking about getting rid of this kind of blind auditioning to get more racial diversity in orchestras. And a lot of people are complaining about that as a bad idea. And in general, I think it is a bad idea. But there might be cases where it's a good idea, depending on what the goal of this orchestra is. So you have to really think about, you know, what is the goal? But if the goal is just get all the people who are the most talented at playing cello or viola or whatever that sound the best, then that technique is a good technique to do it. But is it really a level playing field? Because if we go back, or what people mean by a level playing field, it is in the context of you've created a game and the game has a set of rules, and what the game does is identify who, in effect, sounds the best on the instrument at the time that they walk in the door and so forth and start playing. But the people who are worried about there's not a level playing field in life, or that we're all in some sense Nepo babies, I think would start to think, well, why is so-and-so a better cello player than someone else? After all, she had lessons from when she was 3 and the other person didn't, and her father owned, and moreover, she has a nicer cello now to play. The other person auditioning is auditioning on a cheaper instrument and it doesn't sound as good, and so forth and so on. And all of those things are going to be true. And they're going to not, you know, isolate some kind of raw talent that in this kind of vacuum of context came to the fore. They're going to tell you, like, who actually now can show up and play and sound the best. But there's going to be a million factors into that. And a lot of those factors are going to be things that people are going to think about as unfair or unlevel, that are going to give somebody an advantage, which makes that person now actually play better.
I mean, so I was making that devil's advocate argument on the assumption that the value we all share is finding someone who's the best at the job, whether best performer, or what have you, regardless, you know, depending on what the job is. But that may be over-optimistic assumption, in that I think at least that some of the people complaining about Nepo babies, it's a questionable whether they really care about performance, especially when there are so many other factors that they are saying people need to be hired on, which are also not a result of merit, whether it's representing socioeconomic, racial, ethnic, sexual identity, class, and that's not merit either. So, is there anyone out there who actually believes in merit, or is it just let's pick one arbitrary factor instead of another?
Well, what even is merit here? What is meant by merit? There's no such thing as just merit, period, unless maybe that you mean virtue. But what we're talking about is like who's best for a particular job. And there are going to be a million different factors that are to do with that. How will they get along with the other people with the job? It's going to vary from job to job. There's no life is not a game where we all have places in it, and how well we did at life is what place you rank in the game or something. Life is a process of living, a process of doing things, of producing and creating things, and interacting with other people in all kinds of relationships to do that. And who's a suitable person to be in a relationship with you at a given time is going to depend on a million factors. Or at least many multiple factors, some of which are going to be the possession and degree to which the person has particular skills. And those might be particularly important in many contexts, but there are always going to be other ancillary factors involved. And so there's not just, we ought to be hiring based on merit. In a certain sense, that's true as opposed to favoritism, etc. But then what constitutes merit in the situation is going to, turn on all kinds of details that are going to inquire, to depend on the particular purpose of the organization, the position, the job, etc. And are only going to be really judgeable by the people who are in the situation.
So you've been pushing back on this level playing field metaphor, saying life isn't a game. We shouldn't try to make it like one, as though there's winners and losers. Previously, I asked a devil's advocate question about, but don't we need to assess performance? Well, let me ask another devil's advocate question from a different perspective.
We do generally need to assess performance at all sorts of things and all kinds of times and all kinds of places. And that's what I think justice is about. But it's not about allotting and distributing some, basket of jobs or opportunities to everybody at whole based on their respective merits. It's about a particular person with a particular job he needs done, and he needs done well, finding someone who can do it.
Okay, but especially if this is about justice, here's the – that actually ties in well to my devil's advocate question, because whether we're talking about nepotism, favors from relatives, friends, what have you, or here's another consideration. It's in the same basket. It's not – a favor from a friend or a relative. But like, if you think about Hollywood more generally, there's probably a much larger proportion of Hollywood celebrities who get the jobs that they get just because of the way they look, much bigger proportion than that, than they get it because of help from a family member. Now, that's really something that the person within limits didn't have much to do with. It's the genetics from their parents, but not from a favor that their parents gave them, just the luck of the genetic draw. And you get this, and it's not just luck that you have in virtue of your genetics. It's also like, what does Hollywood happen to have a thing for this year? And which particular good look do you have? Because there's boring good looks and there's extravagant good looks, and it's an inexplicable recipe that they're depending upon. They might not know themselves what it is they're looking for. And so I wonder if part of the reason why this kind of controversy is particularly salient in the entertainment industry is because it's not even about performance. There are probably, for every part that goes up in Hollywood, there's probably 10, 20, 30, equally skilled actors who can do the actual acting chops. But they want someone who looks a certain way to fill a very particular role, given the very particular tastes of the studio and of the audience that they're calculating. And like the person who actually gets the role, that's no merit on their behalf. And it's not even an issue of their performance. It's just blind luck. And so is maybe part of the controversy here coming from various celebrities reflecting on, or aspiring celebrities reflecting on, yeah, it's a real luck of the draw that this one person gets the part and then gets the big break versus this other person. This other person might have had just the same talent, maybe even more talent. And yet, because they didn't have just the right look or whatever and just the right moment, they end up, you know, waiting tables for the rest of their life or whatever. And so you said it's about justice, but how just or fair is it that this genetic lottery is what determines who becomes successful or not, as opposed to anything that people could, you know, choose to make into themselves?
That's not the kind of thing that can be just or unjust. What can be just or unjust are decisions people make. And maybe, you know, policies and some structures and institutions that are built up from the decisions people made. But the world isn't the kind of thing that can be just or unjust. Yeah, there's a lot of luck in life. And people don't even think about where most of their good or bad fortune comes from. The good or bad fortune to be born with just the right look and just the right time and just the right place to become a movie star when added to all the hard work that requires, because it does require a lot of hard work. But the element of luck that helps one person and hinders another in that is trivial, a rounding error, many orders of magnitude smaller than the kind of luck involved being born in the United States versus in Iran. And even that compared to the amount of luck being born in the 21st century rather than in 600 AD or 1100 AD or 800 BC. But there's no you apart from where and when you were born and who you are. That is the one who gets that good luck. There's no like pre-embryo waiting in heaven to be kind of plopped into some uterus in some time or place that gets the good luck to be, you know, implanted in Goldie Hawn rather than in Goldie Hawn in the 70s rather than in some, or 60s, I guess, rather than in some, you know, peasant in Iberia in 1100. The concept of luck you can say you're lucky to be here rather than there, but there's
you
no...
You couldn't have been in the other places. It wouldn't have been you.
And the whole thing is a kind of religious mindset that there's a God that set up the world and he ought to have set it up fairly, or maybe society set up the world, which is just a kind of, you know, slightly secularized version of the same religion, and it ought to have set it up fairly. And it didn't. I could try really hard at something and still not get it. And somebody else could try less hard at it and get it. And I can do everything right and still a particular thing I want doesn't work out my way or works out for somebody else that I think is less worthy. And so I complain to the universe. But that is not an intelligible standard. Only if you think there's a God who's calling the shots is there a question of whether life or the universe or whatever is fair. And there isn't any reason to think there is any such thing. And even if there was, it's not clear that what the plan of such a, you know, being would be could be set up that way. You have to start in judging things by thinking about the nature of reality and the nature of human beings. And here we are in the world with the, you know, faculties we have in the time that we find ourselves with the abilities we have that enables us to form goals and pursue them, to create a life for ourselves and try to pursue that life. And to achieve it or fail to achieve it. And to get closer and closer to what we want or to get further and further behind what we want. There's no preset goal in life. You form your own goals based on the context in which you find yourself. You have to create them for yourself. There's no game to life with a preset what it means to win and what it means to lose. There's living successfully and living unsuccessfully, but not in the manner of winning a game or failing to win a game where there's some preset object. Live this many years, have this much money, have this kind of house, be an A-list celebrity, be this or that. There's no – whatever goals you have – that you're fighting for or working towards or competing with other people in the process of trying to get are goals you formed. What's common to human beings, and you can call the rules of life or the game of life, is just, do you form a set of values that cohere into a self-sustaining life? And do you achieve that? Or do you fail to achieve it? But your achieving it is not competitive with other people. Indeed, quite the reverse. It's only aided by other people succeeding at it. If all the people who got head starts in life over you didn't, you would be worse off, not better off. Think of what it would mean. Everybody around you who was born to a wealthy family and well-educated in that they were taught a lot and whatever, all of those people just didn't exist. Or rather, they were all born in the way cave people were born, knowing nothing and having, you know, very little wealth passed down to them and very little knowledge passed down to them. If you were born in that world, that is the world of the cave people, would you be better off or worse off than being born into the world that you are now, where some people inherit more money and get taught more knowledge and more skills than you inherit and were taught? Obviously, you would be worse off. You'd be worse off without the Nepo babies, so to speak, than you are with them. Except insofar as we think of particular acts of injustice. But the fact that some people have good fortune, if you're not one of them, doesn't make your fortune worse. It makes it better. Because life's not a race or a competition or anything analogous to one.
There's an essay by Ayn Rand called The Age of Envy, which I think is particularly applicable to something, a couple of things that you just said. One point you made a bit earlier was about the mentality of the person who's complaining that they think the so-called distribution is unfair. And then the second is the actual fact of, you know, would things actually be better for you if this system of distribution or this the system by which people are selected to be trading partners actually works? And one of the remarks she makes in it's a wide ranging essay on a lot of subjects. Under the heading of envy, which she understands as not just jealousy, where you want something that somebody else has, but envy in the sense of actually hating people who have good things only because they hate them, not because they've taken from you, but because they got them through their own value. And the value there is whether they earned it or not. I mean, because sometimes you have the good things about you that you didn't earn, that you're lucky to get. But then it's particularly revealing, she thinks, if you hate someone for that reason. In this passage, she explains why. She says, this is particularly clear in much more virulent cases of hatred masked as envy for those who possess personal values or virtues. Hatred for a man or a woman because he or she is beautiful or intelligent or successful or honest or happy. In these cases, the creature has no desire and makes no effort to improve its appearance. Creature being the one who's the hater, she's being dismissive of them. No desire and makes no effort to improve its appearance, to develop or to use its intelligence, to struggle for success, to practice honesty, to be happy. Nothing can make it happy. It knows that the disfigurement or mental collapse or the failure of the immorality or the misery of its victim would not endow it with his or her value. It does not desire value. It desires the value's destruction. So, I mean, think about somebody complaining about the fact, well, someone's born more beautiful than I am, and they didn't earn that. That's the luck of their genes. Okay, let's take away their beauty. Is that going to make you beautiful? Of course not. And so there's not even the semi-plausible veneer of a rationale for what they're saying on the grounds that, oh, there's something unfair in that something's been taken unfairly from me. That would be truly unfair. But the person, there's nothing that's been taken from you. You can't redistribute beauty. that's right. evidence that what the person really is doing is just a kind of nihilistic hatred and not a desire for rectification or something like that.
You might think that there is something taken from you if someone is, through no achievement of their own, more beautiful or more intelligent or more educated than you. I think
what, in recognition? The end,
this isn't right, but we're imagining a situation where you find that someone else is more capable, more beautiful, more intelligent, more something than you, something that's valued by people. And they have more of it than you did, and they don't have more of it than you did because of some better decision or choice they made, but because they lucked into this advantage over you in some way. They maybe it's their genetic endowment, or they had an opportunity when they were young that you didn't. They were taught something, you weren't, whatever the situation is. You might think that what you lose in that situation is an opportunity. You could have had this job if not for this person who came in and outcompeted you. You could have had this spot in the university. You could have had this wife or husband if not for the other person who won their heart instead of you, et cetera, et cetera. But that way of thinking about it supposes that there are a fixed number of opportunities in the world. And there aren't. The opportunities in the world are the creations of people. And they're the things that people create based on abilities that they have. Some of which abilities are, or one of the ingredients in these abilities that people have is their own good choices. And others are the opportunities that they might, have lucked into. But if you think of it, people think, for example, when we're thinking about admissions to higher education, right? Well, there are only so many spots at Harvard. That's not true. Not in any sense that should matter to anyone in the world. There could be 10 or 10 million times as many spots at educational establishments, many times better than Harvard, if only we were to make them. There's not a limited supply of good educational opportunities, good jobs, good people to marry, good anything else. There's what there happened to be right now, but the economy for these things changes, and it changes quickly, right? So it's not that there's some fixed number of things to divvy up unless you have a moment-by-moment mindset. If there were a lot more smarter people, both needing to be educated and able to educate them, then there would be a lot more spots to be educated at really, really great schools. And indeed, there are a lot more spots than there were at times in the past. The human population is growing. And all of these schools, I'm sure, admit more people than they did 200 years ago, and there are more of the schools than there were 200 years ago. These things grow. There's not some finite, scarce resources to divvy up, and if somebody's better than you at something or lucks into a better opportunity than you at something, they're going to get it and you won't. The world is not scarce. There is no scarcity.
So I remember having
except in, minor momentary ways.
But then isn't that – Couldn't somebody who disagrees with your overall position fully concede that and make it a point in their favor? I remember having a conversation once with a fellow academic. We were both professors at the same university, and complaining, as professors at universities who get together to talk or want to do, to bemoan the terrible state of the job market, as we were both visiting assistant professors trying to get a permanent job. And I said something like, yeah, well, I mean, there's this incredible oversupply of professors because the grad schools turn out too many grad students, and that's why there's so many PhDs competing for a sparse number of jobs. And her reply was, no, it's not that there's an oversupply of PhDs. It's that there's an undersupply of education. We should really just be educating more people, and then all of these professors would get jobs. And so by the same token, couldn't someone say to you, well, yeah, precisely because the supply is not fixed, precisely because we can grow the supply, shouldn't society just be investing more in Harvard, let's say, so that more people could go there, so that
– or creating more universities.
Or what have you, yeah. But and educating more students, and then everybody would be better off.
The issue is that there isn't such a thing as society, this one body to do that. I mean, of course it's true that there are particular markets at particular times, particular fields at particular times when there's a lot of one thing and not a lot of another, and more people want one thing than there is that thing to go around right now in that place. Or too few people want it or whatever, and there's an abundance of it. So there is like surplus and scarcity of particular things at particular times. What there isn't surplus and scarcity of is what's worth having in life. That can always be, more of that can always be created. And for any particular thing like education or entertainment or whatever, there always could be more of it if enough people value it and want it. The point isn't that there will be an infinite number of schools or school spots or that there infinitely could be it. It's that there's not a preset number that is set and has to be kind of distributed, and some people are going to lose out on it. And there will be maybe at a given moment, but if there's a bad policy, you know, if universities are being run in a bad way, as I think they are, and many industries are, and the wrong people are being hired, and the thing is kind of getting worse and worse and not improving, etc., that is not benefiting the few people who happen to get the jobs there or who happen to get the good education at the expense of the people who don't. There's not a race where some are winning and some are losing. Everyone's losing in a situation like that.
So
some just are bearing the brunt of it more than others. And if the situation is improved, if someone figures out how to do education better, how to run this industry better, how to make better use of human talent and so forth, everyone who has an interest in it will benefit. So insofar as like, and this is kind of what I mean by saying there's no scarcity. There's not a limited supply of what's good that's going to run out, not on a deeper metaphysical level, not on a level that characterizes how you should think about reality or how you should think of a field. If there is some kind of glut or scarcity or oversupply of one thing versus another in a given field at a given time, that's a problem to be solved. And one should set about trying to solve it or finding a field that's different than that. But the nature of human life is that we're confronted with those kind of problems. A human life is like a series of problems like that and people searching for solutions to them. Not a game.
So I suppose that the devil's advocate point I just made before about, yeah, but couldn't you just increase the supply in favor of the people who are otherwise being excluded from the opportunity? You could read that as a... this person isn't a hater. They don't want to bring people down. They really just want to lift people up. So this is maybe the more benevolent interpretation of what they're saying. But then at the same time, it also strikes me that what would this actually mean in practice if you decided, no, everybody needs to be able to go to Harvard? Say what you like about Harvard. I can say probably many negative things. If even so, but what they represent sort of in the abstract is excellent academic educational standards. Mm-hmm. And if you just decided, let's create a subsidy for Harvard so that everybody can go there who wants to, or even who doesn't want to, that doesn't erase the fact that there are, in fact, differences between people's skills, levels of intelligence, talent, etc., that are currently, however imperfectly, captured by something like Harvard's admission standards. And so then you do have to start to wonder if somebody who, I don't know if there's actually somebody who proposes everybody go to Harvard, but there are people who think everybody or most people should go to college. You have to wonder if those people, do they really want to lift people up, or do they want to eradicate the standards? Because if you overinflate a credential, you do destroy the standard, and you do empty it of meaning, and you eradicate the differences that there are between the people who have certain kinds of skills and talents and abilities and those who don't.
And there's definitely a lot of that kind of leveling that goes on in what people want and what they demand. But to me, the deeper point is whatever the elite education, the best education available, maybe to only a very few people at a given time and place is, right? It's an easy thing to have, not easy, but it's a thing that happened throughout history that a much better kind of education is available to many, many more people some generations later, right? It's, one has to think about, and likewise for any other product, life is dynamic like that. And what that fact indicates is that it's not that there's this fixed supply of good stuff that's being constrained to some people and other people are being excluded from it. There's a process by which good things, opportunities, values of all sorts are created. And what we have to think about is not how to distribute that process fairly, but how to grow it and include, grow it in a way that'll make it possible for more people to be included in it. But just at the most basic level, grow it. Make the process of value production and creation larger. Help the people who are doing it and be one of the people who are doing it on a grander and grander scale. We want to understand what that process is. And that process involves discernment, judgment, justice, production, all kinds of virtues and all kinds of virtues that involve picking out the best people, the best tasks by whatever metrics are relevant to do what you're trying to accomplish, to achieve the values you're trying to achieve in a given time. It's non-egalitarian, but that non-egalitarian character of it is part of the character of human life and human achievement, and human achievement grows on itself. It's not a matter of excluding people from a fixed stock of winning hands. It's a matter of producing hands and producing hands on a greater and greater scale.
Here's a really good example of that point, I think. So it's true, it remains true that not everybody is ever going to be or could ever be a celebrity. Mm-hmm. It remains true that there need to be standards of some kind for deciding who's going to get to be one or not. But if you look at even just the last 20 years, there have got to be many more celebrities now than there have ever been on the planet, and not just celebrities, but many more people plying their trade in the entertainment business in one form or another, just because of the vast growth and outpouring of technology that enables people to offer artistic values to people on a wider and wider scale than has ever been possible before.
It gives people the leisure time to enjoy them and the ability to access them.
I mean, there used to be like three TV networks, and those were the only ones there were, and only a very small amount of prime time.
There were none.
Prior to that, there were none. And now you have, I don't know how many, I've lost count of how many streaming platforms they are that are constantly creating new series, longer form series. And there's YouTube, where, you know, people without even the intervention of the powers that be in Hollywood can become stars overnight just by finding some kind of mix that appeals to an audience and working their way up. I mean, there's people who today are real live big time Hollywood celebrities who got their big break not from nepotism but from YouTube's. Like Justin Bieber is an example of this. I know there's others like him.
Well, we should also not overstress luck, right? Because there's talent involved in each of these things. I think luck plays a role, particularly the luck of being born now rather than, in the Dark Ages somewhere. But even luck about where you're born now. But it's when people achieve things, there are achievements. And the luck is in maybe some of the opportunities they had for those achievements.
And that's why the difference between Anderson Cooper and Hunter Biden is relevant, because there are thousands and thousands of celebrity kids and probably actual beneficiaries of nepotism for whom it didn't do a damn bit of good, for whom it probably made their lives worse, especially when you consider the fact that, like, living in the shadow of a famous parent or whatever actually puts you in certain kinds of psychological disadvantages, that and Some people are able to overcome that and still make something bigger of themselves, not necessarily in the same field, but in some other practical field. And yeah, there's certainly people who through their own hard work and thought are able to create an audience where they had none, but where there was none before, where they had no special help. And add the point about the expansion of technology. I mean, think about it. You often hear this nepotism charge leveled against someone like Bill Gates, because, well, he went to a high school in the Seattle area that had very good computer education program, and his parents were able to afford buying him a computer that he could play with in his garage from a very young age. Yeah, well, okay. That's good luck for all of us because of what he and people like him were able to create, which then put all kinds of tools into our hands that even if we didn't have parents like him, we are now able to produce values for other people like this very podcast. So that goes to your point of we are better off because of other people's good luck.
Yeah.
And certainly not.
We're better off because of other people's achievements. And insofar as luck figures into those achievements, we're better off because of their good luck. We're better off when there are more values in the world. And life is in no way a race, nor anything in any way analogous to a race. There's no winning life over other people. There's winning in the sense of having a good life versus a bad life, but opportunities for a good life build on one another. The more other people are having them around one, the better life one's able to have. And being somehow on top of the heap or better than other people is just not a part of the standards by which it's proper and morally decent to judge your life. Indeed, using those kind of standards just makes you a worse person with a worse life. You judge it by, are you able to find something to do with your time on earth that you love doing, that helps to sustain, that sustains you, because it's producing values that, you know, enable human beings to thrive. And that's what a good life is. And you find one and make one for yourself, and it's aided by other people's doing it. It can also be harmed by other people's being unjust, but other people's being better off than you, having a more perspicuous starting point than you, is not unjust, nor is it just. It's just not one thing or the other. It's not the kind of thing that's morally evaluable, any more than the fact that you were born in the 21st century or the 20th century versus the 19th or 18th or first is morally evaluable.
I often like to make the following kind of point to make sense of the concept of desert, of what it is that we deserve, what we deserve rewards for versus punishments or criticism for. And it has nothing to do with where you start, what you're given. It has everything to do with what you do with what you're given. And if you compare two characters from a book that we both know very well, Atlas Shrugged, Dagny Taggart and James Taggart. And they are interesting to compare in this regard because they're brothers and sisters. And so they're both basically given the exact same opportunities in life. And presumably they even have, so they're both heirs to a business fortune. They're both given a role in the company, in the family business, Taggart Transcontinental, which is this railroad. And presumably they both have, you know, at least roughly equal genetic capacities, because they both have the same parents. Although, of course, James is a man and Dagny is a woman, and that puts her at something of a disadvantage in the society she's growing up in the sometime 50s or 60s, let's say. Nevertheless, Dagny takes what she's given and does a lot with it that James doesn't. She takes her inheritance. She takes the opportunities she's been given. She takes her native intelligence, and she makes herself into something. She becomes a productive, ambitious person who's looking for opportunities to grow the business. Whereas James is more or less coasting with what he's given, not looking to create value, instead looking for ways to tear down Dagny because he envies her for what she's been able to do with herself, while he's been unwilling to build himself into something in the same way. And she deserves what she gets from her efforts in a way that he doesn't, even though they both started from the same place. And
what she gets is a life that she loves. And what he gets is a life that he despises. And I think they each deserve that.
Well, that's true.
But in general, when we talk about dessert, I like to think about deserving from whom. There's a kind of sense in which you could say reality is just in that it, you know, it's such that if you're virtuous, you're likely to do well. And if you're vicious, you're likely to do poorly. And even if, not in conventional terms, in terms of how much money you make or how much recognition you get, there's some ways in which you'll benefit, even if only psychologically, in your state of mind as you're bearing adverse consequences or whatever, you'll be better off being just and unjust. We could talk about whether that's true, about the nature of reality as such, or not in another podcast, but I think dessert is kind of metaphorical there. You don't really deserve things from reality exactly.
But wouldn't you say you deserve, say, to be president of the company from the board?
Yeah, but in that situation, we're talking about a scene in Atlas Shrugged where Jim Taggart is made president of the company when his father died, and that is a case where he doesn't deserve it.
Right.
Right? And it was unjust, and it was one of a number of real injustices in how that company was run and in general in how that society is run that are central to the book.
Yeah.
But when we're saying it's unjust, we have to think about like who it was that was making that decision, what the right grounds for them to have made that decision on were, and what grounds they made it on instead.
Yeah.
And, you know, we go too much in the book to say what it is, but you can come up with all kinds of situations where things are unjust, but it's people who are unjust.
Right.
I could think of lots of situations where I think a job was unjustly given to one person rather than another, or I think an opportunity was unjustly given to one person rather than another. But it's not some cosmic universal thing about how the universe distributed goods. It's this guy, this woman, this board of directors, these people who acted unjustly. And I think those people suffer from acting unjustly when they do, as do their victims. So injustice is a real thing, and nepotism can sometimes name an injustice. I think nepotism, properly understood, is an injustice. It's when somebody unjustly promotes or hires somebody based on a family connection where that's not a relevant qualification.
But if being a member of a family helps you know that somebody is actually really good at this job,
yeah,
and you hire them because of that,
it can sometimes be. And one of the really difficult things in hiring or anything that involves choosing people is, you know, getting in a position where you have enough information about people to know what they're good and bad at, and having a long history with someone or something might well solve that problem for you. There's no kind of place of omniscience to make these decisions from. That's the same kind of, you know, religious kind of fantasy that I talked about in another context before. But there is real injustice. But when we're talking about who deserves what, it's, I think, always from whom. Who deserves what from? Does this student deserve an A from me or a B from me? Does this person deserve an apology from me? Does this person deserve praise or blame from me? Do I deserve this or that from you? Not just dessert kind of in the abstract.
One function of the view you were criticizing before, the idea, well, shouldn't society just create more education, is that it distracts from that question by depersonalizing it and doesn't appreciate the fact that, well, the education that you create is going to come from somebody. The resources of it are going to come from somebody. Usually what they mean is the taxpayers. Those are still real people. Why is it that person X deserves to receive a Harvard education from person Y just because they want it, just because they think they need it, just because they maybe even really do need it, when they have no relationship? The person whose money it's being taken from doesn't know anything about them, doesn't know that providing them with that education is going to improve person Y's life.
Well, it's a lot of what, a lot of the way people think when they think about dessert, when they think about level playing fields, when they think along egalitarian lines, is they tend to think as patients. They tend to think
as opposed to agents.
Yes, as things that things happen to. People who undergo things rather than people who do things. Someone else, it's never quite said who, God, society, the world at large, owes them something. A living, a job, an opportunity, a chance to be famous, whatever it is. And there's a question of how these things are distributed. But the world doesn't work that way, and it can't work that way. Human beings are not fundamentally patients. We're fundamentally agents. We're fundamentally living things, working out how to live in the world, creating things, creating values. And insofar as things get distributed, they get distributed as a result of people doing that. And so if, for example, there are a lot of people with a certain kind of education and not a lot of jobs for them, and you find yourself in that situation, you want to think about, like, why? What can I do about this? Did I make a mistake by pursuing this degree? Was it something that was worth doing even if there wasn't the kind of job I anticipated at the end of it? What should I have been thinking about when I went into this kind of career, went into this kind of training? Was I thinking that or was I not? Suppose I was. Well, then what does that kind of mindset tell me the next step to take is? Suppose I was mistaken. Okay, well, what can I learn from that mistake and do now? Suppose I think, well, there are all these really qualified people able to teach something, but not enough jobs for people teaching it now, given, well, maybe that's an opportunity to create a new kind of institution, a new kind of way of teaching it, a new kind of, you know, to capitalize on all this talent. Do I want to be the one who does that? Do I want to be the person who makes, you know, my career creating the business or industry or new niche that'll do that? Maybe not. Maybe that's not an interest of mine, but here's what I want to do instead. But I don't resent that no one else has done it for me.
It's interesting how the kinds of things that people seem to have the most resentment about when it comes to egalitarian concerns about distribution of rewards are not always, but very often at least, they're the kinds of things where they're concerned about recognition. They're concerned about, they've been patients. They've been passive in the way they think about what's actually good in life. They're accepting, well, everybody wants this, and I'm not being given this thing that everybody wants, and it's unfair because now everybody's going to look at me and see that I didn't get the thing that they all value. And it does make you think more first-handed, independent thought about what's actually good in life. If you were that way from the beginning, you wouldn't even get to the point of resenting the fact that somebody else has something that you don't. You'd be thinking, how can I make something better for myself?
Yeah. And what do you want to do? And there are, you know, I don't mean to say there can't be cases where there's a particular injustice against you and it rankles. I know cases like that. About particular, you know, why did this person do this at this time and so forth. But in almost all cases, if that's kind of defining your life, I think it can only be because you're not taking positive steps to do something about it. I mean, if you think about the worst kinds of injustices, put aside literal slavery for a moment where you're actually, you know, or confined to it, you have no way out for your whole life. But even people who started as slaves, think of people like Frederick Douglass, who suffered tremendous injustices, right?
Taught himself to read by stealing away in the night to get lessons.
Right. Or of Ida Wells, whose newspaper was burned down and she was run out of town, and all these kinds of things. What is the story of those people's lives? The ones that we know about, right? The people like that, the ones that are admirable. It's not that they were victims. They were certainly victims, but they didn't let it end there. They found something to do with their lives that they could be proud of, that they loved despite the victimhood, and they kind of transformed it. And I think most people in most times have an opportunity to do that at some scale, at some level. that when they think about their lives, the things that sucked about it, the things that were unjust to them, however real many of them are, aren't the things that define what their life was about. What defines what their life was about was what they did. And if there's such a thing as winning life, that's what it is. And there's no contest that we could say, you know, they came in 36th place versus 34th or first or second. There's no scale on which all those lives are commensurable. There's, have you made something out of your life that you love and that's worth living? And if to you the loudest things in your conception of your life are what's been done to you, I think you're not doing that. And maybe there are some situations, surely there are, where what's happened to you is so horrible that there's no way around it. There's nothing, your life's just been ruined by other people's injustice against you. But that's not the case for any of the people who are writing articles complaining about rich celebrity kids or people who had a advantage over them in this or that competition or this other thing, even if some of those things really are injustices some of the time.
We've gotten a couple of comments from YouTube. I don't know if you want to say anything about this, but let's see. One is just a comment, and then the second's a question. Comment: interestingly enough, plumbing and the other trades, at least in New York, is wildly sought after and a classic example of what people would call nepotism in both ways. So this isn't all about Hollywood celebrities. But then here's a question. Is Donald Trump a product of nepotism?
So Donald Trump is someone who inherited a family business. You could say that when he came to be a manager in the family business, and when he came to have the position he had, his father, you know, who took him on in that role, ought to have hired the best guy for the job, whoever that was. And maybe the best guy for the job wasn't Donald Trump. But one, I don't really think that makes sense. It was a kind of family business, and it was going to be inherited by his children. And it's not clear. It's not like they were stockholders or something to which the father owed this. And moreover, we don't have any reason, I think, to think that the father didn't think that his son, who he had raised and groomed around the business and taught the trade or whatever, he may well have been the best guy for the job, at least as far as his father was concerned. So he's somebody who certainly, you know, was born with opportunities that other people don't have, both that he inherited some money and that he was offered a place in this family business. But I don't think there's necessarily any injustice involved in that. There's a lot of things I don't think are admirable about Donald Trump. I think he's an evil person and has led a horrible life to the great detriment of himself and the rest of the world. But I don't think this is a particular problem with
him. But at least he's not a product of nepotism.
Well, that's not the worst thing you can be, but...
Now, what about Ivanka Trump becoming director of the Office of Economic Initiatives and Entrepreneurship in the White House?
Yeah, I think Trump's children having the kinds of positions that they did is due to what happened. I certainly kind of things like the kind of some of the financial dealings that the kids of all these politicians get, Hunter Biden and Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump and so forth, is a kind of grift.
It's interesting, a question from a perspective of, I guess, parenting ethics. When it's appropriate to, if it ever is, to cut a child you love slack, and when you should just cut them off. How bad does it have to get? I remember reading a story when I lived in New Orleans about vagabond assaults tourist somewhere in the French Quarter, and you read the name of the vagabond who was subsequently arrested, and his name was recognizable surname from a local family of celebrities, and I looked him up, and it was the son of like one of these very famous trial lawyers who has commercials on TV every day and do the digging. And it turns out, it's a kid with a lot of problems whose parents tried to help him. But at a certain time, they said, sorry, we're not going to help out anymore. You've made a mess of yourself. And And this is how he ends up being the vagabond who's throwing things at tourists. And
I think there's a real difference between the issue of kind of do you give someone a job and so forth that they don't deserve? Where what you mean by don't deserve is there's someone else who could do the job better, and you'd be better served by having that person do it. Versus do you inherit or disinherit your children? Giving money to your children by way of inheritance or helping them out or something is a kind of consumption, not a kind of production. It's sort of like what you do with your earnings, not part of how you earn it. And I think there are questions about what is just or unjust in doing that. But it's just a different kind of question that I think comes up in the idea of hiring. What you want to do, with a child, anyone who wants to have a child, I think, wants to provide them with every opportunity and wants to use their resources to do for the child whatever will make them able to flourish and do as much as possible for themselves in life and to have opportunities on a grander and grander scale. But there are ways of giving children resources that don't help them but hinder them, that, let them sustain destructive kind of habits that give them more than they're capable of using and let them screw it up. And I think it's got to be hard to figure out just where that line is, particularly with adult children and particularly for parents who have really outsized resources, such that they can, put in their children's hands amounts of money that would confront them with large scale decisions that they're not equipped to make. Imagine like a billionaire giving $1 billion to his kids. I think the giving pledge that a lot of these billionaires make, I think Bill Gates included, who we mentioned, is altruistic and immoral. But the idea that you don't want to leave your children with gigantic fortunes, I think there's a real logic to that. I think that kind of a fortune is a tremendous responsibility.
It can screw you up if
most people aren't equipped to handle.
Yeah. I always liked the, isn't there a scheme of sort that the Danconia, family uses in Atlas Shrugged where,
that you're not born of Danconia,
you have to become one. And so even though they could just decide to give, pass the company down from generation to generation, it's only going to happen if the heir earns it in some sense, in the sense of demonstrating that they have the ability to actually handle things.
I think we're probably at about time we're ready to wrap up. If there's nobody who wants to say anything, either in person or online.
All right. Well, sounds like we have some question about whether we'll do an episode next week.
I think so. Next week is Valentine's Day.
You don't want to choose that as an issue to discuss?
If we're going to do it, it'd have to be on love, I think. But also, we have wives here. This is to be. So I thought about doing it another day next week, but it looks like there's not another day that works out well. So I think we're going to have to skip next week, and we'll be back 2 weeks from now. I'm not sure what we're going to be talking about, but we will look at what's going on in the world and choose an issue.
All right.
Thanks for watching, and hopefully we'll have a kind of cool graphic to go with it.
Thanks, everyone.
This has been Choose Your Issues, the podcast of the Objectivism Program of the Salem Center, recorded live in the McCombs School of Business at the University of Texas, Austin. Opinions expressed herein are those of the speakers and do not reflect the views of the university or any of its component units.